It's spring, 2008, and this is Intern Edition from NPR. On April 6th, the D.C. cab system will actually have a system.
Nothing but cabs. Two lanes of nothing but cabs.
Our reporter follows one man's struggle against the change. And you think you're playing the video game, but is the game playing you?
In the end, what separates a man from a slave?
Our show is about stories and how we tell them. I'm Tyrone Martin. It's Intern Edition. So I'm standing out here at the corner of Massachusetts and 6th, not too far from the NPR building. Now, as anyone here in Washington knows, hailing a cab can be confusing, mainly because you never know how much it's going to cost. We get charged by zones here in the city, and really, I don't know what that means. And now I'm actually trying to hail one. There are a couple taxis coming this way. Sir, how much is it to get to Freedom Plaza?
Freedom Plaza, $6.50, $8.
$8?
Yes.
Okay, all right, thank you. Taxi! Sir, how much is it to get to Freedom Plaza?
$9.
$9?
Yeah.
All right. Now for the cab driver's side of the story, here's Ariel Kitch.
Nathan Price is leading a motorcade of cabs down 16th Street in Washington, D.C., ignoring the hands that try to wave him down for a fare.
We started the Conburn and we came all the way down 16th Street.
Nathan is the chairman of the D.C. Coalition of Taxi Cab Drivers. He leans into the seat of his orange and black cab. His graying hair is combed back over his head and his large hands are on the steering wheel. Today, he's leading a line of taxis to Freedom Plaza as part of a 24-hour strike.
Matter of fact, we're going to come right back out this street right here, and we're going to circle Freedom Plaza.
And you're the leader?
I'm the leader for right now.
His cab has become his office.
And let this thing drive me crazy. Yes, Mr. Reedy. Huh? Any what?
The D.C. cab drivers were shocked this fall when they learned that Mayor Adrian Fenty was passing an executive order that required all cabs to install time-distance meters, a change that D.C. cabs have long fought against. Time is running out. By April 6th, meters must be installed in all 6,500 D.C. cabs.
I don't know. I'm waiting on a wagon. He keeps stopping completely in traffic. And I say, wagon, you can't stop completely. Because in Washington, you stop like that, you know, you're dealing with, downtown, you're dealing with Homeland Security. But he says, well, I'm willing to go to jail.
But keeping the striking cab drivers in line is the least of Nathan's problems. The D.C. cab drivers are a group with deep divisions that make organizing a campaign against the city's policies an ongoing struggle.
It's been a monumental task, just getting them all down the same table.
All the cab drivers?
Oh, man. There's so many ethnic frictions, you know, tribal frictions.
Nathan is convinced that if the D.C. cab drivers don't organize soon, the changes proposed by the city will deprive them of their most distinct advantage, the ability to own their own cabs, turning them into small-time entrepreneurs. Meters, it's rumored, could lead to medallions, the notorious New York City cab system that keeps control in the hands of company owners and dramatically cuts down on the number of cabs allowed on the streets.
What happens is that we lose our jobs because you can't put 6,500 time distance meter cabs into a small enclave as downtown D.C. We have to preserve that. If we lose that, then they starve us to death.
When Nathan makes it to Freedom Plaza, he stands at the center of the square and watches the cabs roll in from the Capitol building, clogging the streets and honking their horns.
What are we seeing down there?
Nothing but cabs. Two lanes of nothing but cabs.
Even though he's been able to get everyone to the same plaza, Nathan still has no means to direct the drivers, who continue to honk while he waves his arms in the air to make them stop.
The only thing disturbing is the honking of the horns. You know, that's a city violation that I'm opposed to. I think the message got across.
But while the honking cab drivers at Freedom Plaza clearly communicated their frustration, the strike had no effect on city policy. Several weeks later, Nathan has changed tactics. He's begun to organize meetings with the heads of the ethnic groups that control the cab industry.
Let me
This morning, he's meeting with the Indian Cab Drivers Association.
No. Guests in the house, my house always have a chair.
The Indian cab drivers gather on the sides of the room as Nathan begins to speak. The room is quiet as they wait to see what he'll say.
I've been like far removed from all the different ethnic groups, you know, because they don't come to me. Now I'm glad that we're starting to come together, because our blood is that we all drive taxi cabs. That's our commonality, and that's the thing we have to fight for.
Nathan needs the help of the cab drivers to file suit against the city.
No, we are here because what we are going to do about it?
What we're going to do about it? All thing we can do is constantly sue them.
Because sue them, right? Sue them.
By the end of the meeting, the cab drivers have pulled out their wallets and are counting out contributions to the campaign.
Thank you very much, sir. Thank you very much.
Cab drivers remain divided by ethnicity, class, or company, and most D.C. citizens still support the change to meters. Realistically, Nathan and the cab drivers are up against a long fight, even if the lawsuit they filed last month keeps the city from moving forward with changes. But Nathan is already imagining the next strike. He's hoping that this time he'll be able to unite the D.C. taxi drivers in one wave, ignoring the divisions that have held them apart in the past. For Intern Edition, I'm Ariel Kitch.
To see Ariel's hand-drawn radio story, visit our website at npr.org/internedition. Back in January, I received an email telling of the impending demise, so to speak, of the nation's largest black-owned book chain. It was the cause of great commotion here in Washington, but I didn't have time to pay much attention to it. I'm the Tell Me More intern. I was thrown in right away. But then I discovered that Caribou's closing was actually related to a trend in the black community. So I took a trip to the chain's last store on its final day to find out more.
50% off everything, regular and sale prices.
Local teacher Dorothea Chapel and other bargain hunters shuffle through the crowded aisles, claiming the last few hardbacks and novels left on almost bare shelves. Many customers had no idea Caribou Books was closing.
You have got to be kidding me.
At one point, Caribou boasted 6 stores. But after 15 years, Caribou now folds into a trend. According to federal government research, black-owned small businesses fail at higher rates than any other minority-owned firms in the country.
What we call that survival rate is lower.
That's Dr. Ying Lowry, a senior economist with the Small Business Administration. She says a series of factors can account for the low survival rate. The most telling, however, is that most black businesses lag behind in capital.
The capital I'm talking about is not only we call physical capital, like assets or equipment, money, but also that include human capital. Education, experience, and the second part is a physical capital. And the third part is a social capital.
Social capital? In other words, success in the small business world is closely related to family cohesion. According to census data, the African American community lacks many of these vital links because of its high number of absent parents, unwed mothers, and failed marriages. This especially sobering reality for blacks in America is often reflected in the fate of their small businesses.
Based on my experience in meeting other entrepreneurs, I would agree with that.
Simba Sana is the co-founder and CEO of Caribou Books.
I think the failure of Caribou is connected to issues in the black community.
Sana says conflicts with loved ones and his business partner forced him to close the book on Caribou. He was hesitant to go into detail about his family troubles. But now he's turning the page on a new chapter in his life.
We have to somehow learn to feel good about ourselves so that we can put our best foot forward in the world.
It may take time to correct this trend in the black community, but experts see signs of progress. Dr. Lowry says despite the high rate of failure among black businesses, the African-American entrepreneurial spirit is thriving.
Definitely a black-owned business, the growth rate of the number, the business number, is faster. Which is a good sign. That means just like sports, if you have more people participate, big stars come out.
And more stars lead to improved social capital, which ultimately benefits the black community. Back at Caribou, a few regular customers pace in disbelief. One stands motionless, grim. as if offering the store's last rites.
This is it, man. I can't believe after today it's going to be no more Caribou. It's hard, man.
People here say they're worried because it's a great loss to their community. Customer Dwan Little is clutching a Walter Mosley book, the last one from the shelves.
It's just a loss, that's all. And any loss is sad.
The reaction was humbling for the CEO, Simba Sana. He says his customers became a surrogate family. But despite his loss, Sana is optimistic.
This to me is not a sad day. I do hope to stay in bookselling, and I hope something comes back that will be bigger and better than what we've had.
I'm Tyrone Martin, and this is Intern Edition.
Everyone wants to know, how's it going to end?
We're told that people don't like to wait anymore, that text messaging and email feed our insatiable appetite for immediacy. But the thing is, people love good stories. We always have. Technology doesn't stand in the way of that. In fact, now it's part of it. Travis Larchuk tells us about how the generation that grew up on Super Mario has made good storytelling interactive.
The year is 1960. Sean Ryan's creeping down a dark corridor in a run-down underwater city where mutants or killer robots could be waiting for him around the next corner.
Oh, God.
Sean's 20 years old. He goes to the University of Dayton in Ohio, and he loves this game, BioShock.
The storyline of this game is phenomenal. It's the most... Oh, my God.
He's about to fight a giant mechanical man.
Oh, my God. Big Daddy time.
In the game's story, the Big Daddies are protecting these little girls who have been mutated by the city's founders. So once Sean kills the Big Daddy, he has a choice to make. He can either cure the little girl, which will give him a little bit of power, or kill her, which will give him a lot more power. Okay, it sounds weird, but this plot point ties into the game's bigger question. How far are you willing to go in your own self-interest?
And I think, you know, in order for games to become a fully mature media, they need to be able to explore complicated moral themes. And one of the themes of BioShock is the extent of capitalism.
That's Ken Levine. He created BioShock using themes from Ayn Rand's books Atlas Shrugged and The Fountainhead as inspiration for the game's plot, where ruthless philosophy leads to the underwater city's downfall. Critics have almost universally praised the game's story, and in February, BioShock won the award for Best Writing at the Game Developers Conference in San Francisco. We've entered a new era in video game storytelling. Video game writer Susan O'Connor says back when games were new, people didn't expect complex stories because the novelty of playing a video game was still fresh, kind of like when movies first came out.
A woman gets tied to a train track, some guy twirls his, like, naughty mustache, here comes a train, he twirls his mustache, her eyes open really big. I mean, technically it's a story, but it's not a very sophisticated one.
As any movie critic will tell you, a director can't just throw anything up on the screen and expect to impress people. Audiences want well-told stories. It's the same way with video games. Now designers have to figure out how to tell a good story and keep the game interactive. Interactive storytelling gets a lot of attention at Carnegie Mellon
University's Entertainment Technology Center
in Pittsburgh. Walk through a hallway that's been transformed into the bridge of a spaceship with pulsing purple lights and electrified plastic discs, past a model of the fictional robot Gort from The Day the Earth Stood Still, and you'll find Professor Jesse Schell. He says it's tough to use mature storytelling elements like tragedy or loss when players know they can try again and correct their mistakes.
No one could make an interactive Romeo and Juliet, for example, because if you had both characters die, you'd say, well, I guess we did that wrong. Let's go back and get the right ending.
O'Connor says the challenge is to create a situation where the player can suspend his disbelief and accept the world of the game. For example, say the player needs to walk into a room and get some vital information from a guy behind a desk.
So what we don't want to have happen is the player walk into the room and immediately shoot the guy behind the desk, right? You know, you don't want to just disable the gun the minute he walks in because that's going to make the player angry. So you figure out a story reason to get the gun away from him, you know. He's an African warlord, so the guard is going to take your gun away before you walk in.
Schell calls this plot device indirect control.
You do what you want to do, but only because I created a situation where I knew what you were going to want to do. So you had freedom, but at the same time you did exactly what the storyteller wanted you to do.
Last year, even the Writers Guild of America started an award for video game writing. But as a character in BioShock asks,
in the end, what separates a man from a slave?
Gamers may have to ask themselves how much they're controlling the game and how much the game's story is controlling them. For Intern Edition, I'm Travis Larchuk.
There's a garden just outside the Fort Totten Metro stop in Washington, D.C. You could easily pass it by without a second thought. Hundreds of people do every day. But in this forgotten corner of the city, Benny's still planting seeds. Listen to what he has to say.
I am Benny Harris, Jr. And this is Mamie D. Lee Community Garden Association.
Benny Harris is lean and weathered, wearing a black felt cowboy hat and a coarse gray beard. He's been gardening here since the early 80s and has watched it change over the years.
When I first came here, we had a really good group of people, but over the years they died out. They all was older group. Probably it's only two people still gardening here when I started.
He leads me over to a tree stump at the top of the garden and nudges it with a boot.
We had a big old tree right there, man. Right here, this is where we used to have our meetings.
When Benny looks down at the stump, you can see how it stands for the garden's past. The cool shade used to make a good meeting spot for all the gardeners in the heat of a D.C. summer. They kept the ivy cut back, and the tree thrived. But a few years ago, the Park Service made them stop. The ivy spread, and the tree died. This seems to be the story not just of the tree, but of the garden itself. A combination of neglect, regulation, and old age has taken a toll. As Benny's generation begins to fade away, more and more plots lie empty.
Let's see how these are.
Harold Stone is the new manager at Mamie Lee. He stands between the generation of gardeners who grew up in the rural South around World War II and the young urban professionals who are rediscovering gardening today.
Wow. Amy grows a great carrot.
Harold is passionate about revitalizing this place, but he's also humbled and almost reverent about the work ethic and philosophy of the older generation.
I get so much from these people, from the people in the garden. It is humbling. There is a grace about them. There's just a lot of grace in the way they look at things, respond to things. I've got a lot to learn.
Gardeners like Benny are quietly teaching by example. On one plot, a new gardener is growing sunflowers right in the middle of their garden.
This is one thing on the garden today. First thing they want to do is put down sunflowers.
Why is that?
I have no idea. With a garden, I would never put nothing tall in the middle because the shades, everything on each side of it from the sun.
The divide between Benny's generation of urban farmers and the young professionals who may replace them is clear in their gardens. The traditional, clean, straight rows of okra, tomatoes, and collards contrast with the more youthful, experimental mounds and spirals of herbs and sunflowers.
The older gardeners, in my mind, it's almost like must. They must do this. It's in their bones to produce a crop. And it's an outlet for them to connect with a long-standing tradition in their lives.
But Harold says that for young folks, it's more of a hobby than a way of life. You can't see one of the new gardeners coming out if they were sick or if it was raining.
However, some of our older gardeners will come out with two canes to be in their garden, to work in their garden.
Harold says this new generation can learn more than just gardening from Benny.
It took me a while to really understand that what they were giving was advice. A lot of times it just seemed like, oh, just conversation. But there was a whole lot more there.
Our world is full of choices. We pick out colleges and careers and hobbies and clothes to define who we are. Benny's generation began gardening out of necessity. They keep gardening because it's in their blood. It's who they are. It's a kind of hard-headed pragmatism that comes out of a very different era. an era that only survives in guys like Benny and in anyone who's willing to listen.
And it took me slowing down to really listen to them, and I do a lot less talking now, a lot more listening, and the listening is got a lot of space in between it because there's not a whole lot said.
For Intern Edition, I'm Eric Verkirky.
To see the audio slideshow for this story, visit our website at npr.org/internedition.
Lazy butterfly, napping on me, dreaming of the sky, and roly-polies, wake up, wake up.
Have you ever fantasized about your high school English teacher? What she does at night or on the weekends? Well, let me tell you a secret. We know the truth about her. She spends her time at the Doll Factory in Los Angeles. Jolie Myers has more.
This probably isn't the first time you've heard of roller derby. Thousands of women across the country are joining a revival of the full-contact sport made popular in the 60s and 70s. The new generation of derby girls fight it out on the track during monthly matches or bouts. But they're also fighting to balance day jobs with their derby nights. Derby doll Sheila Noonan slips her fishnet-clad feet into a battered pair of skates. She's wearing hot pants and heavy makeup. For Noonan, better known as Hot Wheels, it's game time. Her team, the naughty cop-themed Sirens, are last year's reigning champions. But the undefeated Girl Scouts Gone Wrong Tough Cookies are looking to keep their winning streak alive.
Come on!
Miniskirts, stage makeup, and campy theatrics collide, quite literally, during bouts at the Doll Factory.
Right now, I am suffering from a bruised knee.
But Noonan has to manage another clash off the track.
I'm a high school English and literature teacher.
Before she assumes her derby alter ego, Hot Wheels is Ms. Noonan, a popular high school English teacher.
Tiebreaker. B as in boy. And you're right again! The answer is B as in boy. Use verbal technique.
The disconnect between her day job and her nightlife is apparent. But souvenirs from violent bouts sometimes follow her into the classroom. Worried students force her to come clean about her after-work activities.
Maria, thank you so much. You did a wonderful job. I started showing up banged up, and they were unbelievably concerned for my safety and well-being. And so I explained, no, I'm just playing this game. I fall down a lot. I'm actually doing the hurting to myself. Luckily, you have to be 21 to come check out our games, which makes me pretty happy, so I don't have to worry about any of them showing up while I'm still competitive.
Like Noonan, most skaters have to reconcile derby with their careers. Megan Gaynor is a West Hollywood librarian by day. Judy Gloom comes out at night.
I work in a library. Like, how much more sedate can you get than that? And then I, you know, come here in the evenings and take bitches out. It's a completely different world. You know, a lot of people talk about that, about how, like, the sport is so great because it helps them get, you know, all their aggression out, and, you know, they work a lot of their personal issues out on the track. And yeah, I guess that applies for me too.
The Tough Cookies beat Noonan Sirens in a come-from-behind victory. There were some hard hits and bruised egos. But for the Derby Dolls, winning is doing what you love, whether by day or by night. For Intern Edition, I'm Jolie Myers.
To see Jolie's roller derby audio slideshow, go to our website, npr.org/internedition.
Cincinnati with my whole head nappy, made a rally in the street with nothing but a beat.
What's so special about a song? For Public Enemy's Chuck D, a good song is powerful. As he says himself, you can make a rally in the street with nothing but a beat. For a different Chuck, Chuck E, the hero of our next piece, The Revolution, starts in the classroom. Will Hoffman brings us this story from New York.
Laughing, 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 laughing comes the song.
My name's Olivia. I'm 9 years old, and I'm in fourth grade.
My name's Jonah. I'm in the fourth grade, and I'm nine.
I'm Chet. I'm 9 years old. I'm in third grade.
I forgot to say, I didn't even introduce myself. I'm sorry. But I'm Chuck, Chucky. My friends call me Chucky. And what I do is write songs and sing songs, and I travel around the country and play them.
You know I could get one of your CDs?
Oh, we could talk about that later. First, real quick, we don't have a whole lot of time today, so I just want to know what kind of experience you have with music.
I think I started singing when I was 4 years old, except I was really, really, really bad at it.
I'm nervous to sing. I've done it a couple of times and just kind of make up people's songs.
Do you do it in the shower?
What I want to do is we got to write about something that we all can relate to. So it could be funny. It could be, you know, it doesn't have to be sad or it doesn't have to be, you know, too emotional or anything. What were you guys thinking when you woke up this morning?
In the morning, I was basically thinking about my crazy dreams.
No,
I did.
But we can write about disappointment that it wasn't a snow day today.
Mom promised me, but then it never happened.
It was a snow day that never was.
I was looking forward to going and watching my mom go to meetings.
Let's do this. We're gonna do 5 minutes of free writing, but now what we're gonna write about is the snow day that never was. Same rules, there are no real rules. I'm giving you 5 minutes, go for it.
Mom and Dad promised a good delay to get a really nice snow delay.
I woke up in the morning and saw that there wasn't going to be a delay.
I walked down the stairs, still stiff and dreary from sleep. I looked on the internet, then started to weep. The roads
thinking
were
of snow, wanting to know if there really was a snow day.
Like, woke up and I saw, what did I see?
3 inches that was.
3 inches of slush. Do we want to say sad or do we not want to say sad?
We don't want to say sad. No. We need to rhyme with saw.
Any ideas?
Yeah.
Woke up against and I saw was definitely against the law.
Against the kids' law.
Okay. We got to say something about the snow day. That rhymes with slush.
The hope of snow day was all mush.
No, but it really did kind of turn to mush.
I know, that's what's so that's what's brilliant about it. Don't you see?
Brilliant!
Are you ready? One, two, here we go.
First.
Sleeping in my bed, hopes of snow filled my head, in my pajamas, inside out.
Well, if you really have a heart for music, it's fun to just write at free.
Pick a silly name and a silly subject and just start making the silliest tune you can and it'll turn into this great song.
Woke up and I saw should've been against the law.
The kids, nothing stupid. It's all stupid. It's not stupid because they're kids or because they're beginners. It's just stupid because we're like having a good time and learning, and it's just there's no pressure at all, you know? See, if only I could be in third grade now and get up and play my songs, I'd probably blow some people away.
My snow day turned to mush.
I like it.
I do too.
Yeah. That's perfect.
For Intern Edition, this is Will Hoffman.
That was really fun.
And the winner is Hov, my man. Speech. First of all, I want to thank my connection.
Intern Edition would not be possible without the support of NPR's professional staff. So let's throw some shout-outs to our mentors. Rena Advani, Jessica Baker, Rob Ballinger, Elizabeth Blair, Felix Contreras, Elaine Heinzman, David Malikoff, Ned Wharton, and in New York, Robert Krolwich. In Los Angeles, Jacob Conrad, Theo Mondel, Kenya Young. Our engineers are Ivan Burkett, Paris Morgan, Andy Rosenberg, and Gerald Tennant.
Carry the work cross state for a gentleman. Yeah, thanks to all the hustlers, and most importantly, you, the customer.
Our webmaster was Travis Larchuk. Ariel Kitch picked our music with Kaylee Chan and drew our comics with Lindsay Toddy. Laura Buckles edited all our photos. Our communications team is Janine Anafitarte, Rachel Warden, and Erica Evans. Our blog editor was Megan Forbes, and our show editor was Eric Verkirky. Our associate producers were Ariel and Eric. Our executive producer is Zoe Chase, the project manager and godfather of the next generation of National Public Radio. Is Doug Mitchell.
A month from now, this Hollywood big shot's gonna give you what you want. I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
I'm your host, Tyrone Martin. Thanks for listening.
I get away with murder.